CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
But first, we'd like to thank our sponsors. Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter. And finally, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, we are bringing news from CFO Magazine. The heading of the article is Most Likely to Commit Fraud, Financial Executives, an article written by Mary Leone. The report is based on the analysis of 348 fraud cases that KPMG as a firm investigated over the past 4 years. A lot of bad apples work for the corporate finance department, but the number is shrinking, says the new study from KPMG. The report released this month says the typical corporate fraudster is a senior finance executive, and that of the employees who commit fraud, 32% of them work in corporate finance, the highest percentage of any corporate department. 4 years ago, this number was 36% of fraudsters worked in corporate finance. Now, since the last study, new trends and behaviors have emerged, including the statistic that CEOs are the fastest growing group of fraudsters today. Indeed, those committing fraud, 26%, according to the 2011 analysis, are chief executives, compared with 11% in 2007. Further, this year's study found an increase in cases in which fraudsters exploited weak internal controls, an area where the firm KPMG is very heavily focused. The instances of that happening rose from 49% in the 2007 analysis to 74% in 2011. KPMG reasons that the dreary economy and the economic climate may be partially to blame, as budget tightening forced some companies to cut costs related to upkeep and monitoring of internal control processes. Total fraud losses in the cases investigated by KPMG varied by geography. In the Asia-Pacific region, the average loss was $1.4 million, followed by $1.1 million in the Americas and $900,000 in the Europe, Middle East, Africa region. Most fraud cases involved some kind of material misstatements of financial results, theft of cash or assets, and abuse of expenses. But rarely is an act of fraud a one-off, the study wrote. For instance, financial statement fraud requires wrongdoers to make multiple transactions to cover their tracks. As a result, fraudsters usually commit multiple acts of malfeasance, with 96% of the fraudsters in the 2011 analysis repeating their offense, up from 91% previous. Looking at gender, men are more likely to commit fraud, with 87% perpetrating them in the 2011 analysis. However, that may be partly a reflection of the workforce in general, as women are underrepresented in senior management positions, thereby giving them fewer opportunities to commit fraud. In the end, the most powerful motivation for fraud is still greed and personal gain. The impulse can come in different packages. For example, attempts to conceal losses or poor performance, often related to pressures to meet budget and targets, boost bonuses, or to hang on to a job. The author suggests that companies fall victim to misreporting and other types of fraud, and that they should consider whether they set too onerous targets and exert excessive pressure on employees to achieve them. So in wrap-up on our news article, the profile of a fraudster in the KPMG 2011 analysis. He's male. He's between the ages of 36 and 45 years of age. He commits fraud against his own employer. He works in the finance function or in a finance-related role, holds a senior management position, and has been employed by the company for more than 10 years and works in collusion with another perpetrator. Well, here I am. I'm about to work in collusion with a perpetrator, and that is Mark Randall. He's joining us today as Chief Financial Officer and co-founder of Swipe for Change, a merchant service provider with a very unique twist on helping charities save and raise money. Prior to forming Swipe for Change, Mark spent 28 years in the commercial real estate development industry. Wood Partners, under Mark's leadership, was responsible for the financing, development, and disposition of over 10,000 apartments in 35 projects with a capitalization of over $1.3 billion. And that represented a very varied portfolio of multifamily housing, including market-rate apartments, workforce housing, age-restricted apartments, student housing, as well as a variety of condominiums. Previous to this, Mark was Regional Vice President of Development for Gable Residential Trust, a REIT, and prior to that, Senior Vice President of Construction Operations for Post Properties, also a REIT. Mark graduated from the Georgia Institute of Technology with a Bachelor of Science degree in Building Construction. So welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Well, Mark, let's get straight into it. We're going to start at the beginning. Some of our guests on the radio show, their first position has been maybe on the lemonade stand. One even was a gymnast and at the age of 14 was earning more than she did at 30 years old. Let's start at the beginning with you. What was your first job and how did you arrive at the current position?
Well, my first job was a job as a project manager on a $24 million apartment project. So I kind of was baptized by fire. I had moved into an apartment. It was under construction. The rest of the project was under construction. And I just asked who was building it. And I had not quite finished my degree at Georgia Tech. I was 2 months away. Found out who the fellow was. Scheduled an appointment with him. Ended up being the president of the company. We hit it off quite well. And the next day I had a job. So,
wow. You must have really shone in his eyes.
I guess so. I mean, I had a great degree from Georgia Tech, a fantastic program that really prepared me for what I was doing, and I think he recognized that.
So building construction, from a non-educated perspective, I can imagine that that brings in an element of business, but also the engineering and the construction side of the business.
Yeah, it's really a fabulous degree. It actually brings in a lot of disciplines from engineering, civil engineering, structural engineering, architecture, architectural history, and also some business and finance courses. So it's and legal. So it's quite a well-rounded degree. That was one of the things that appealed to me about it. It was not so specific that it limited me to one particular industry.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. So many degrees today have recognized the need to have business, particularly finance, maybe elements of economics, elements of marketing, or as you mentioned, legal. Being that I've been in the finance profession, I've always found that being a good backdrop for me. But today's students, I think, need it more and more. The competitive marketplace, not only for your first job, but also in business, I think it's a very good foundation for the future.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, so why did you take the path from being non-financial in construction, a very expansive career in REITs? You've co-founded Swipe for Change, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But what brought you into being the CFO? Was it your passion for the business?
Well, it was a combination of a few things. My passion for the business, certainly that. I love numbers. I love the art of putting the deal together. I love the challenge of structuring financing, putting a business plan together, all those things that go into really setting up a company from the beginning. And coming from the real estate background that I have come from, all of our projects were separate legal entities and all had different financial structures. So I came to the table really with a lot of different experience on different ways to structure a deal. Now, given specialized in real estate financing, obviously, but you know, it gave me a great platform to kind of understand the different ways that we could structure our business.
And so your career within that construction industry was really financing. Tell us a little bit about the financing for real estate. Obviously, today's economic climate has hurt a lot of industries, but most importantly, real estate. Is there anything unique to real estate financing that perhaps is different from a typical, let's say, manufacturing company?
Yeah, I think, for a real estate developer, which is who I work for, you're doing a new deal, you know, every year, hopefully several deals a year. You're always looking for new resources of financing. You're looking everywhere from here locally to across the ocean. Many of our projects were financed with European equity. So you're always dealing with a different group of folks.
And is it typical institutional investors?
It's a combination of everything from the prudential institutional insurance companies to the funds that literally raise, you know, 10,000 euros at a time to syndicate equity together to do projects. One of the largest projects that I did was done with that type of equity.
And it's a heavily regulated environment here in the U.S.?
Yes, it is. I mean, I think many would argue that the debt side of the equation should have been regulated a little better. But yes, it is very heavily regulated.
So here we are, CFO of Swipe for a Change. Tell us a little bit about the company. I think it's important that certainly in the merchant service providing and payment solutions industry, there are a lot of players. But you have a very unique twist to your company. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we in looking at starting up this company, this actually started with a mission and a passion for trying to create a way to generate sustainable, consistent revenue stream for charity. And Maha Ebieri, who is our CEO, and myself started looking at different business functions that were kind of the necessary evils of business, things like insurance, credit card processing, et cetera, and looking for ways that we could innovate the way those particular products are sold to try to find a way to create a margin where we could give back to charity and to give a significant amount of our gross margin to charity, not our profit, so that it really challenged us to come up with systems, with kind of methods and back of house production to be able to do that and a completely different way of selling that product. It's a very competitive industry, but one that also is fairly easy to get into and not very capital intensive in the beginning. So it was a great way for us to kind of start up a business, and we believe we've taken a great product and innovated it in a way that will create that margin for us to be able to give back.
And you have partnered with one of the largest firms that provides these solutions. Do you want to give a shout out for them?
That's correct. We have partnered with a company called Elavon. We are a registered merchant service provider for that company. Fully registered with Visa, MasterCard, et cetera. So we've got that direct relationship with them. I believe they have about 200 MSPs like us within their group. We're one of their newest.
So tell us a little bit about the company's business model. Payment solutions, as a user of the processes, I understand that there are certain elements of what I would could describe as costs. It can be a quite complex cost measure. And certainly my experience is that when you speak with one merchant service provider, they may use a little slightly variation on terms. From a CFO perspective, you've really got to run the numbers with volume to understand what your net cost is going to be at the end of the day. But tell us a little bit about the mechanics of the actual processing, if you would, mm-hmm. and just a little bit about the makeup of how that all works from a end user perspective.
Okay, I'll try to make it simple.
Yeah.
The credit card business is actually a very complicated business, but there are, excuse me, basically three players that are the key players in the process in addition to us. The first are the networks, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, those people that you're most familiar with. The second in that process are the banks. And the banks are really the biggest player, excuse me, from the standpoint of the cost of that service to the merchant. The third player in that process is the processing company, which would be like Elavon, the people that we are working with, and they provide all of the back-of-house services. They're the ones that actually do all of the physical processing of the payment through the banks and then back to the merchants.
So that would be like a First Data or one of those other companies as
correct.
Well?
Correct. First Data, Bank of America, Chase Merchant Services, Global Payments. Those are the large players in addition to Elavon in that business.
Great.
And so you have all of those players, and in the end you have the merchant service providers, which are companies like ours, who provide that service, who actually sell the product for these companies, although many of these companies sell their product directly as well. They really rely on a network of merchant service providers to do that for them. And, you know, the pricing actually is not that complicated. The interesting thing about this business is that everybody pays the same interchange rate.
And that's the charge from the bank.
That's an interchange rate is set by Visa, MasterCard, and the banks. And that is the basic rate that's paid on cards. The complicated part is, in the U.S., there are over 400 interchange rates. So depending on the type of card you show up with, does it have rewards, does it not, is it debit, there are all types of things that affect that. The cost can vary greatly, as much as 2% to the merchant. So it's very, very difficult if you are down to the pricing where you're basically at an interchange plus pricing. You may get a statement with as many as 150 different types of cards that have been run that month. And for a merchant who's just trying to run a business, it's very complicated to sort all that out and to figure it out. And that's where a lot of the bad things about our industry come into play, where people really do play games to try to get people to switch over to them, promising the lowest cost, when in reality they've just looked at one statement or two statements and picked one particular card that happened to show up that month, and they've cut that rate. So there's a lot of games that are played, a lot of smoke and mirrors, and it's very, very frustrating for the business owner in trying to sort through and figure that out.
And I remember the first time that I set up it was a relatively small payment processing cycle. My discussions with, I guess it would be the MSP, there were various different names for the variety of costs, some of which were based on volume, some of which were just monthly charges, and some of which seemed to vary based on the nature of the card that was being processed, obviously different charges there. But then there was this cost that it kind of came and hit me in the rear end, didn't expect it, called the commission. And that was a cost. In my world, commission is a benefit.
Yes.
But that certainly was not a benefit, and it was a little bit hidden from me, didn't expect it. And sometimes there are the terminology that is used is very unique.
Yes, and I think every statement looks different, and there's a reason for that. Many will describe certain interchange rates in a way that are very hard to track and to figure out. There are all kinds of places in a statement where markups can occur. And so what we've done in kind of our mission and what we're really trying to do here is do something good and truly make a difference every day. We are taking a whole different process or attitude towards statements. Our statements are going to be very clear. They're not going to be hard to read. Our customers are going to know exactly what they're paying for. And where we're making money, they're going to know where we're making money. Because making money is how we give to charity. If we did not have a margin and if we did not have that, then we could not be able to take an ordinary cost of their business and really convert it into a donation.
So let's talk a little bit about that, Mark. Essentially, let's say I'm ABC Corporation and I decide to come with you as my provider. Let's say I put $1,000 through your business this month, and there are certain processing fees, that aside. Is there a proportion of that $1,000 that I can designate to a charity? How does that work?
Well, the way it works with us, we go into a business and we basically tell the business owner, we will process your credit card for the same price that you're paying today. If you're a new business, we will price you at what would be competitive for a business of your size. If we see opportunities to improve that, one of our first examples was a little restaurant out in Cobb County named Christos, an old pizzeria, Greek restaurant. We actually went in. He's been in business for 31 years. And we took one look at his statement and realized that he was paying way too much. We saved him $2,500 a year on his statements. And we're giving over $1,000 to Armed Forces Charities, which is a big part of his customers who come from the local Air Force base here. So it's a way for us to go in and one, basically just take what they pay today. We never ask them to pay more. We just take a share of that and divert it to a charity that they get to choose. And in doing so, one of the magics of this is that we get introduced into a lot of small regional charities who really need help. The big players, the Susan G. Komens of the world, they get a lot of money. As you see, you can't go in a grocery store without seeing the pink ribbon. It's the small charities that in tough times like this that really do suffer, who are relying on those year-end donations. And more than 85% of most charities' donations come in the last 2 months of the year. We're providing them with a consistent stream of revenue that's not subject to the downturns in the economy. In fact, if anything, people use their credit cards more. in tough times. So we're creating a consistent revenue stream for that charity, which they very much appreciate.
So, Mark, if a charity wanted to use you as a service provider, I know that there are some accounting packages that have that linkage already within, almost embedded within software, but there are some that don't have that, if you will, connectivity. If a charity wanted to come to you, let's say, I don't know, CARE or United Nations, mm-hmm. one of the ones that we all know and love, or one of the smaller ones that you describe, would they be able to feed back some of that little extra component that wouldn't go to a charity to back to themselves?
That's exactly right. The way that works is if they chose us to be their merchant service provider, one, charities, especially the small ones, are notoriously priced very high, even though they are very, very low risk. And pricing for merchant service providers is really based on the risk that particular business has. And there are no chargebacks in the charity arena. There are no real significant risks there yet. They tend to be charged higher rates because their financial statements aren't necessarily that strong, even though, you know, they do, they're not that likely to fail on you and leave you with a big deposit. So they, because of that, we are able to go in and lower their rates typically. We're also able to then turn that same donation back around to the charity of their choice, which, of course, is themselves. There are also programs that we are offering. We do customize this as well. If a charity is willing to bring people to training with us, teach them how to sell, and they deliver completed applications to us, we actually will pay them additional monies in the way of, in effect, commissions. For bringing those businesses to us.
So almost the perhaps the executive director or the people that are managing donations and gifts from those donors, whether it be I guess it would be a corporation in this instance, they can promote this. I'm very familiar with the likes of United Way that have a payment solution option as a deduction for employees. This is essentially one that you could potentially provide through to your vendors.
Correct.
And then they create the relationship with you, and they are able to take a fraction off the top as well.
That's right. And the beauty of this business is it's no cost to the merchant, and it's no cost to the charity to sign up with our program. It is our mission to reduce people's cost and at the same time give something back to the community.
Fabulous.
And by structuring our business that way from the ground up, we believe that we're going to be able to do that and maybe set an example for some new businesses that come out in the future to say, you know what, it is a possibility to innovate a business and in the process give something back to the community.
And I think it's fabulous. The payment processing solutions industry is all about recurring revenue. It's a repetitive natured sale, if you will, mm-hmm. or product. And that being said, once it's occurred and it's set up, it's just the dime keeps clicking.
Yeah, I want to mention one more thing. One of the real important parts of what we've done, and we've spent a lot of time setting this company up, we've put in place processes for the charities to be able to see what's happening with their references and with the people that they've referred to us, to be able to actually go on and track those. And those are some of the proprietary, patent pending things that we've done to really help bring the whole circle together. This is not a new concept. What we're doing is really innovating something that many people have tried, but no one has really picked up on what the full circle is.
That's great. I love it. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of your personal passion, and certainly you bring this to your role of CFO. In our discussions, I understand that part of the passion that you bring to today's role really is consistent from the real estate experience that you've had. You're a believer that a CFO should be a leader of building relationships and partnerships, and you've done that in your career, certainly in the real estate business, and now you're doing that with the corporations that you have as your customers and the charities with whom you work. But explain a little bit more about what you mean for a CFO should be a leader of building relationships. Explain a little bit more about your philosophy around that and how that impacts your role as CFO.
I truly believe that some of the greatest efficiencies that a business can have are related to relationships. If you're out there, I learned this in the construction business. If you're out there beating your head against the wall trying to get the lowest bid from the next subcontractor that you have really no experience with, you pay heavy dumb taxes, is what I would call them. Whereas if you go and you find good, honest, reputable, loyal subcontractors in that case, what you find is you may not always pay the very lowest price, but you've got somebody there when you run up against trouble, because you always run up against trouble in business. Those are the people who really carry you through, and you carry them through. One, it makes business a lot more fun. It makes getting up and going to work every day much better. And what I have found in the end is I truly believe you pay less. Because over the long haul, when you really factor in all of the intangible costs of changing folks that you do business with, retraining them, going through lawsuits, all the things that you experience when you really do play in a much bigger world, it really ends up being cheaper. And that's not to say that you never check them. You always do. You know, you always have more than one source, so that you can keep people honest, because people. And I say honest, it's really not the right term.
But keep them on the right track.
Exactly.
Keep them on your track.
People don't get greedy, they get lazy. And they'll take the easiest path, and the easiest path is just to charge more money sometimes. And if they can, they will. So you're always having to check against that. But at the end of the day, when you can really narrow down, especially in your professionals, your legal, your financial, when you can narrow down to a very narrow choice of people that you really get to know and they get to know you, it really creates great efficiencies in business, and it's something that I've lived by my whole career and found to be very important.
Well, certainly in terms of the initial stages of your company and founding it, relationships that are key are those that may create opportunities for the actual funds and the investment, the cash in the bank. You have chosen a little bit of a different path for your business. You've done the whole bootstrapping. You've self-funded. Was that a decision based on something that you decided for the Economic Times? Fundraising for a startup is a tough thing to do these days. Or is it more a passion of, you know what, I'm going to do this myself and I'm going to be beholden to no one else?
Well, I think it really, I think the primary reason is that because we are embarking on something that we believe is innovative and is new, and does have a greater value, that if we had brought someone in as an investor in a merchant service provider, we would have gotten paid, you know, just the commodity price. We believe we have something much more special than that. And again, fortunately, this is a business. Fortunately, unfortunately, there's a lot of people that get in this business and really don't do their homework and get started, and they can be successful. We've done our homework, and we've spent the time to do this right. We've spent more than a year developing our systems, our software, and our marketing.
And you've taken an approach of having some very specific niche customers that can be that heraldry or referral partner for you.
Absolutely. I mean, we focused on people who have a lot of relationships in the community. One of the things that's been quite a pleasant surprise is how many of the people that come from my real estate industry that serve on boards of charities, that have relationships out in the community. And even just when I sit down and tell them about what it is that I'm doing now that I've kind of steered away from the real estate development business, they are a wealth of resources, and they get very excited about what we're doing. Even though they really don't have anything necessarily personally to gain, they understand this concept very quickly, and they have been some of our best salespeople. Our first customers, I will tell you, in this industry, when you bring on a new customer, it's very rare that you would get the recommendation that someone would stick their neck out and say, you know what, here's two other guys I would recommend you go talk to about credit card processing. Our experience with, because of why we're doing this and what we're doing, it is not uncommon for us to get a list of 5 or 10 businesses from the business that we board saying, you've got to talk to these people. I'm sure they're paying too much for their credit card processing and they need to know what it is that you're doing. Even in the case of the Dobbins Air Force Base, the fellow, Christos, who owns the restaurant, actually has connected us now to the man who runs the base. And, of course, he's going to be out encouraging other businesses to give to the Wounded Warriors. So it's an interesting thing to see how that network works and how those relationships work. And if you do these things with people who care, we're not a solution for everybody in the business. We're probably the only credit card company that will walk out of somebody's business and tell them it's not a fit. Because if it's not a fit, if there's not a margin there, or if the customer does not, or the merchant does not believe in giving back, then we're wasting our time. They're not going to go through the trouble of changing over to us if that's the primary reason to do so.
Having said that, there are an awful lot of companies who want to give back to the community. And part of the challenge for, typically it's going to be the CFO and those heading up the operational budgets, is how do you give to the community in terms of charitable donations when you're scratching for that 1% to be able to add to your own bottom line? It's a very, very difficult challenge in today's environment. And through your processing options, that doesn't really come from their bottom line.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't come from their bottom line. It does from their current bottom line, but it doesn't add anything to their costs.
Right.
And the write-off is already there. They already write off the credit card processing. So they're not looking for that charitable write-off. What they're looking for is just to give to that cause that maybe this year they couldn't give to.
Sure.
And now they have a way.
Sure. Well, explain to the listeners a little bit about the merchant side of payment processing, if you would. We've talked a little bit about the real estate business being regulated, and is the payment processing industry itself highly regulated?
It is. It's interesting because it's primarily regulated by the networks, Visa, MasterCard. It's a book that they produce on all the things you can and cannot do. There's a lot of regulation in place that really protects the consumer, the PCI compliance, which is basically making sure that people's credit card numbers are protected, so that they don't get, you know, the software is not there for them to be able to, like, record, write down credit card numbers, things like that. They're very regulated in that regard. And then they're regulated on things that they can do, like, for example, can you offer a cash discount? Typically speaking, you can, but you can't. You can't charge more for credit cards. That's not a government regulation. That's a Visa, MasterCard regulation, inappropriately so. So there are, I would say the industry overall is primarily regulated by the actual industry itself, the networks, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover.
And are those firms all U.S.-based? I must say I'm somewhat lacking in knowledge on that.
Yeah, I believe they all are. They all started in the U.S., and of course they're out worldwide now, and
sure,
they've acquired different companies across the world. But yes, they're primarily U.S. based.
Well, often CFOs are going to look to change a payment processor based on their desire to save costs. Are there any aspects of the costs that you think are relevant to discussion today for those listening to be able to learn and become a little bit more educated about that?
Yeah, I would encourage most merchants who are using credit card services, especially those who have any reasonable amount of volume, you know, north of, let's just say, $200,000 a year in processing, really consider and ask for what's called interchange plus pricing. It is the best way to know that you are getting what you pay for. It does take a little bit of courage because your rate will vary month to month, just depending on the Russian roulette of who shows up through your door and what card they use. But the more people use debit cards, you will get rewarded for that. The more people who use regular credit cards, not rewards cards, you will get rewarded for that. If you go, you know, many people use tiered structure, which is nothing wrong with that. It is easier to predict what your costs are going to be. But those tiers are marked such that everything that falls under that tier of processing is going to make money, or at least break out even for the processing company. So I encourage my friends to go with Interchange Plus. It's a little scarier, but you at least know exactly what the markup is that you're paying to the merchant service provider, and that it's fair and appropriate to the industry size and type that you're in.
Well, interestingly enough, I think stepping one stage back from that, the conversation may also be to encourage CFOs to look at multiple elements of transactions and income sources, whether it be from customers that are typically what I would call retail customers, as well as those that may be just other corporations such as themselves, to consider those payments coming into them on a credit card basis. For the corporation itself, it enables them to have more of a timely payment. It enables them to have a what I would call a a standard relationship for that payment processing, because you're using the banking relationships and the payment processing that's set up by them. But more and more companies now are looking to have payments being done by credit card. Certainly legal firms, accounting firms, one-off companies that you may deal with, as well as the big corporations. And one of the things that I have also found is that when you have business relationships, in order for some of the larger firms to pay you, they are now looking to pay you on some kind of a credit card basis. There was a large Fortune 10 company that one of my clients did business with, and they were essentially asked or told that they would be being paid by Amex on a regular monthly basis. And for the corporation, they were not used to that. They were used to charging their customers, but not being received on that basis.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the important things to note about that is that, it is a cost of business that, that especially small businesses that are operating on very small margins. I mean, an effective rate of somewhere around 3%, or in some cases can get as high as over 3.5%.
And that can take away your profit.
That's a big chunk of your profit. But what they don't tend to recognize or realize, especially if they've always been accepting credit cards, is that the average customer spends about 30% more on product when they use a credit card. So, yes, you may be paying that lower margin or maybe, encroaching on your margin, but the reality is they do buy more. The other benefit of credit cards, especially today, our particular company offers next day funding. So someone who processes cards today gets that money in their bank tomorrow. So you're not waiting on a check. You're not waiting on somebody to remember to pay you. None of those features. I mean, if you are signed up with someone or you accept those credit cards, you know that you're getting that money that next day or that day of what they've signed up for recurring billing. So you can, I think, encourage people to pay bills that they may have otherwise had to wait to pay. And I truly believe that in many industries, you sell much, much more product when you can accept a credit card. And that's an intangible benefit that oftentimes gets lost in the struggles to keep a business profitable. But the reality is, without that additional sales, I'm not sure you'd be all that profitable. So that's something that we always battle in this industry. We always battle the cost of this service, but the reality is, when you compare it to the old days of keeping a ledger and having personal accounts and all those fun things that I grew up with in a small town, this is a heck of a lot better way to get paid.
And interestingly enough, from a consumer perspective, I come from Europe, and for decades, Europe has had majority of your individual personal bill payment being done through an automated fashion. Last time I wrote a check in the UK was a long, 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 long time ago. And typically, all of your monthly bills are going to be just standardly put up through a banking or a credit card processing. And that has come through changes in the last, I would say, decade in the US, but it's nowhere near the that of Europe. And I do think that part of that heralds from the fact that the US banking, the processing of the engine of what creates the banking solutions is actually, in my opinion, way behind much of the rest of the world. And some of the fraud that I believe takes place is as a result of some of those payment processing, certainly canceling of checks and cashing of checks and those sorts of things, which have been banned for decades in many places elsewhere in the world, still occurs in the U.S. But we're seeing a move from a consumer perspective, paying your mortgage, paying your electricity, paying your gas, paying, your gardener or your housekeeper. I mean, all those different elements and to have an opportunity where, from a consumer perspective, you can potentially come through you, that would be advantageous.
Yeah, and the other thing that we offer, I mean, for those people who do still insist on writing a check, is that we actually can offer a program where, using the same systems, you can get your check approved and you can actually get what we call guaranteed payment, which basically means you pay a little bit more in fee to electronically process that check at the cash register, but it's guaranteed. There's no need to worry about NSFs. If there is one, it's our company's problem, not the business owners. So we've actually now have processes in place because they can go out and verify funds are there, so that you can make sure that those checks are good. Interesting that you say that, though. We have our partner, Brian Mann, who is actually the guy who's produced all of the development software for our business, the proprietary things that we've developed. He is in his late 20s, and he has never written a check. So, you know, yeah, the younger consumer that's coming out into the market today is completely accustomed to just using and relying on their debit card, which is a check, and their credit card. So I think that industry is going to change as time moves forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as a CFO, obviously the stage of growth of your business is such that you're still in the early stages of development, but you've got customers, you've got established relationships, and you've got repeat customers, so you've got a trend going, and you've got some good income coming in. But what keeps you up at night? Is it the risk of what you don't know that's going to hit tomorrow? Is it customer-oriented? Is it employee-oriented and the growth elements of how you grow your business?
You know, I think for me as a CFO, especially when you're in the business of creating something innovative, I did something very similar when I was in the real estate development business, in that we started building high-rise condominiums here in Atlanta, and we developed a product that was completely different than anybody else in the industry, and most people were telling us, you're crazy, you've lost your minds. The real difficult thing there was protecting that concept. I think what keeps me up at night, and I believe we have very, very good systems and agreements and things in place to protect this idea as we roll it forward, because, you know, the challenge of growing too fast versus too slow, or maybe I should say too slow versus fast enough to stay ahead of the competition is important. I think the good news for us in this business is the type of margin that we are giving up is not something that an existing company with an existing sales force and an existing method of doing so is going to be able to copy with very much ease.
So the intellectual property asset of making sure that your products and your sales can remain the ownership of your business.
Exactly. And protecting those things, I think, was my number one concern. The second concern, obviously, is, you know, what's happening in the economy, not related to our business, because I do believe, you know, not being in real estate, I sleep better at night knowing that that I've got an industry that's not so dependent on the economy. But as we look to grow the business, and at some point in time, we will seek outside capital. Our hope is certainly to keep it private, not to go public, because I don't trust the public company to be willing to maintain what it is that we've created, and that is that donation stream to charity. One of our challenges will be raising the right kind of money. So we've got to get out there and prove our product, and we've got to get out there and prove that we will retain our customers at a rate that's many, many times higher than our competitors, that we will be able to maintain a really good profitability, because people won't feel so bad about writing that check for the merchant service processing anymore, knowing that a good portion of it's going to go to something they care about.
Yeah, I think a very, very strong model, and certainly I just love the charitable aspect of it. Here on CFO Radio, once a month, we give our guest spot to a charity, a nonprofit. It's a way that, from a owner of a business, that I can give back to the community. But I do believe that the role of CFO for the charities is as challenging, if not more challenging, as a very highly regulated, even public corporation, because of the fact that, number one, your tax returns are public information, but number two, you mentioned it earlier, your revenue stream stops and starts each year. You know, in finance, in my early education days, I learned of the concept zero-based budget. Well, I don't think it gets much more zero-based than a charity.
Exactly. I mean, they're a completely cash business. They really thrive and live and die based on that cash flow and that revenue coming in. And having a predictable way to at least budget for one piece of your revenue stream through participating in our program and really co-branding and contracting with us in promoting our brand and promoting the businesses that support our brand and support your charity, you're giving back to yourself. And for the businesses, it's in a way for them to show to the community that they care and they do give back. And, you know, today that's become a necessary thing in your in marketing. I mean, you don't see any major company that's not doing cause-based marketing and cause branding. What we do is we offer the opportunity not for somebody to buy a special yogurt and give to a very specific charity. We offer an opportunity for somebody to give every single day if they just choose a business that supports Swipe for Change.
Well, Mark, we have a tradition on the show to ask all of our guests, I'm going to put you on the spot, their CFO tip of the month. From the perspective that you have of your role of not only operations, but now the CFO, what is your CFO tip of the month?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think the CFO tip of the month is really, really consistently every day work on that balance of overhead and making sure that as you grow a company, and that's my focus today, and has been my focus throughout my career because I've been involved in growing a lot of operations, really, really focusing on not hiring that person until you really need them. And putting systems in place that really support your business. And because when times do turn and times get tough, and they will, the worst thing to have to deal with is people. There's nothing worse than having to sit down and lay off good people. And if you really maintain a really efficient overhead and an efficient operation, and that can be painful during good times when everybody's saying, wait a minute, you know, why do I have to work that much harder? Why can't we just hire this person to help out? Really keeping a close eye on that overhead is really what ultimately is the right thing, not just for your company, for your investors, but for the people who work for that company, and creating that sense of place and family and where people really do enjoy getting up and going to work every day. And what a great thing to wake up every day and know you're giving to charity.
So, I think it's great. Well, Mark Randall, thank you for being our guest today and for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO, and certainly giving us a very deep entree into payment processing. It's a complex area, and I think you've helped us simplify it for our listeners. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank our contributor to CFO Magazine and also to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and finance executives. Their website can be found at www.financialexecutives.com. org, and National Association of Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. See their website at nacdonline.org. Well, this and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. And thank you for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.